This is a clip from our recent appearance on Assassinations, where we covered the murder of politician Leo Ryan by members of the People's Temple on the Port Kaituma airstrip. To listen to the full episode now, subscribe to Assassinations on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
People think that in this day and age of media scrutiny and government oversight, that things like this won't happen. And I think people need to understand that those aren't protections against another Jonestown.
On November 17, 1978, Congressman Leo Ryan landed at Port Kaituma Airstrip in Guyana. Ryan, the picture-perfect, idealistic American politician, began the hour-long trek to a jungle compound that housed nearly 1,000 American citizens. The compound's members moved thousands of miles away from home in the hopes of finding salvation and freedom in Jonestown, the new headquarters of the People's Temple.
Ryan arrived at the jungle commune to overwhelming cheers and applause. There, he finally came face to face with the People's Temple's leader, Jim Jones, a drug-addled Midwestern preacher well beyond his prime. At the end of that meeting, neither of them would leave the compound alive. One death can change the world. At least that's what assassins believe.
Welcome to Assassinations on the Parcast Network. Every Monday, we examine the famous assassins of history and the men and women who were assassinated. I'm your host, Bill Thomas.
And I'm your host, Kate Leonard. This is our first episode on Congressman Leo Ryan, who was killed by members of the People's Temple on November 18, 1978. To help us understand the motives of Ryan's assassins, we've asked our friends from Parcast's podcast, Cults, to join us.
Hi, I'm Greg.
And I'm Vanessa. Every Tuesday on Cults, we take a deep dive into the psychology of cult leaders and the people who follow them.
Today, we're here to offer some deeper insight into what happened behind the scenes at Jonestown leading up to the massacre.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
No arrests were ever made for the murder of Congressman Leo Ryan. However, the unknown gunmen who pulled the trigger weren't the real masterminds of the assassination. They were brainwashed by a man who was responsible for nearly 1,000 deaths in his quest to build a paradise.
Congressman Leo Ryan and People's Temple leader Jim Jones were closer ideologically than one might assume. They both believed the American way of life was unfair to the working classes and that the country's most vulnerable were being taken advantage of. They both viewed themselves as the voice of the underprivileged, although they couldn't have taken more different paths in pursuits of a shared goal. Their journeys both ended at the same isolated compound in the Guyanese jungle.
To understand what the People's Temple became, we need to start at the beginning. In 1951, at the age of 20, Jim Jones and his new bride, Marceline Baldwin, bought their first house together in Indianapolis, Indiana. As soon as they settled in, Jones began preaching at a local Methodist church.
Plucking ideas from Marxism, Jones urged the churchgoers to come together for a higher purpose, something greater than the money they were killing themselves to earn. In one sermon, he criticized American capitalism by saying, "It seems gross to me that one human being would have so much more than another."
Most scholars argue that Jones didn't fully comprehend the communist philosophy he was preaching, beyond the basic idea that capitalism is bad. Historian Mark Lane once met with Jones and concluded, "His scholarship in Marxist ideology was so deficient that he might have experienced difficulty in distinguishing between the words of Karl Marx and Groucho Marx."
even as communism became a hot-button issue throughout the 50s, it wasn't the political ideology echoing through Jones's pews that got him in trouble. It was the radical racial equality that Jones preached.
Jones and his wife, Marceline, adopted children from many different ethnic backgrounds. They were the first white couple in the state of Indiana to adopt a black child. The couple charmingly referred to their household as a rainbow family.
Jones wanted to integrate more people of color into his congregation, but the Methodist church he preached at wasn't as keen on desegregation. So in 1956, Jones left and opened his own church in Indianapolis, the People's Temple Full Gospel Church.
The People's Temple didn't follow a specific ideology. Jones borrowed ideas from religions and scholars on every end of the philosophical spectrum. He even borrowed the practice of faith healings he'd witnessed at a Baptist church.
During his services, Jones would bring a person with an illness or disability on stage, shout some prayers as loud as he could, and then smack them on the head to knock the demons out, thereby healing them, allegedly.
According to sociology professor Gary Maynard from Stony Brook University, Jones's preaching style displayed a grandiose sense of self-importance and an excessive need for admiration. These are often considered characteristics of narcissism.
Before we go any further, just a brief disclaimer. Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. Maynard writes that Jones displayed many, if not all, of the symptoms of narcissistic personality disorder over the course of his career. For example, claiming to have magical healing abilities. But because he was so charming and persuasive, most of his congregation didn't challenge his behavior.
Whether his faith healings were actually effective or not, Jones's attention-grabbing antics did succeed in bringing in more followers than he ever could have imagined. This meant more money in his pockets.
Jones viewed his congregation as a sort of religious commune based on his misinformed understanding of socialist principles. He asked his members to give up all their possessions to the temple, and in turn, they would be taken care of by the church.
What this meant in practice was that parishioners would sign over their social security and welfare checks, and Jones would promise to repay them once the church became more sustainable. Not a cent was ever repaid.
By 1961, 5 years after the People's Temple opened, Jones felt the church had reached its full potential in the Midwest. He wanted to move his congregation to a new location to grow their reach, but none of his followers wanted to leave their homes in Indianapolis.
Dr. Robert Cialdini, a psychology professor at Arizona State University, suggested another possible motivation for the move, exerting more control over his followers. By taking his followers out of their familiar environment and placing them in unfamiliar surroundings, Jones could foster a sense of uncertainty and disconnection within his congregation.
Around the same time, Jones told his churchgoers he had a nightmarish premonition that Chicago, of all places, would fall victim to a nuclear attack by 1965, and the fallout would reach Indiana. He claimed the entire Midwest would burn, like Hiroshima and Nagasaki had, less than two decades before. His followers, who trusted his word above all else, agreed it was time to move.
And off to California they went. The hippie movement that was taking off in San Francisco aligned closely with Jones's own values. But San Francisco was a bit pricey, so by 1965, Jones and his followers set up shop in nearby Redwood Valley.
Jones spent the next decade in California, opening temples all across the state, from Sacramento to Los Angeles. As the hippie movement's doctrine of freedom and equality gained popularity, so did the People's Temple. And Jones, with his rock star black sunglasses, became a full-fledged celebrity.
By the late 60s, Jones's weekly sermons in San Francisco drew upwards of 3,000 listeners. He found supporters in prominent figures, including Jane Fonda, First Lady Rosalynn Carter, Vice President Walter Mondale, and California Governor Jerry Brown.
But behind the scenes, the People's Temple wasn't as peaceful as it seemed. By the late 60s, Jones had picked up a serious addiction to both heroin and cocaine, and it only exacerbated his naturally bad temper. He would often physically and sexually assault the male temple members. The abuse was treated like an open secret within the People's Temple. Everyone knew about it, but no one spoke of it.
Jones also began to use temple funds for a private army, which would come to be known as the Red Brigade. The army served as Jones's personal security detail and was also used to intimidate and harass anyone who spoke poorly about the temple.
Perhaps the most shocking abuse of power came in 1972, when Jones coerced temple members Timothy and Grace Stone to sign away the parental rights of their newborn son, John. Timothy resisted, but after 2 weeks of intense pressure, he agreed to sign an affidavit stating that Jim Jones was the legal father of baby John, and that the child would be bound to Jones and the church for life.
These abuses would not stay secret for long. Later in 1972, journalist Lester Kinsolving released a series of exposés detailing the physical abuse at the People's Temple, as well as Jones's drug use and allegations of money laundering.
Jones immediately tried to hush up the reports by claiming that the allegations were totally fabricated. Some of Jones's high-profile supporters stood by him, but to much of the public, he'd been revealed as the same sort of exploitative false prophet he'd always condemned in his sermons.
The following year, in 1973, 8 People's Temple members defected from the church. They feared Jones wouldn't allow them to leave the temple's headquarters if they asked, so they escaped in secret and fled to Montana.
Once they reached safety, they sent Jones a letter detailing the reasons why they left. The letter made it explicitly clear that it wasn't Jones the defectors were upset with. They'd had issues with his staff. But in Jones's mind, an attack on his staff was an attack on himself. He sent his security force, the Red Brigade, to hunt down the defectors and seek retribution.
Fortunately, they were able to elude the brigade for long enough that Jones eventually called off the hit. And by the beginning of the next year, Jones had much bigger problems to worry about.
In early 1973, Jones visited an infamous gay hookup spot in Los Angeles that was under surveillance by the LAPD. Jones propositioned a sex worker who turned out to be an undercover police officer and was arrested immediately for soliciting sex. His legal team fought hard and was able to have the case sealed and removed from the public record, but word had already spread to the media. With members fleeing and bad press mounting, Jones realized he needed to leave California and find a place where he'd have total control over his church.
This was an escalation of the same strategy he'd employed years earlier when he'd moved the temple headquarters from Indiana to California. Jones looked into multiple locations before landing on a poverty-stricken country in the middle of South America called Guyana.
After a brief visit to Georgetown, the country's capital, Jones knew Guyana would make a perfect home. It matched both of his prerequisites. It was quiet, and it was far, far away from the American government and press. Once he returned stateside in the summer of 1974, he sent some of his temple members down to the jungles to begin clearing trees and building cabins. His loyal follower, Timothy Stone, served as the liaison between the capital of Georgetown and the new township, which they christened Jonestown.
Timothy's wife, Grace, refused to join him. She was fed up with Jones's manipulation and verbal abuse, and she begged Timothy to leave the church before things got any worse, but he refused.
Although Grace and Timothy both joined the People's Temple at around the same time, Timothy seems to have been closer to Jim Jones. While Grace was able to see Jones's abuse as a red flag, Timothy was too blinded by Jones's good side, his charitable works, charisma, and confidence.
The Jonestown building project became more urgent on August 1, 1977, when Jones received an unexpected phone call from New West magazine. The publication was about to release an article exposing the People's Temple's inner workings. Jones still counted a number of very powerful figures among his supporters, including California Governor Jerry Brown. So, as a show of respect, The magazine's editors called Jones and gave him notice that the piece was going to run the next day.
Jones sat with his lawyers and closest associates while the article was read to him over the phone. The piece detailed the charitable work Jones had done with the ACLU and NAACP, the temple's social programs for children, soup kitchens, etc. But then the article pivoted towards the darker aspects of the church, the physical and sexual abuse, financial crimes, and misuse of members' government aid checks.
While the editors were speaking, Jones scribbled down on a piece of paper, quote, "We leave tonight. Notify Georgetown."
That was fascinating. To hear more about how cult dynamics influenced this assassination, be sure to listen to the rest of this episode and tune in for part 2 on April 1st by subscribing to Assassinations.